Welcome to Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast. We've launched this brand new series to explore all things education, from teaching to research to finding out why we're one of the leading departments in the country and the world. I'm your host, Heather Shurkinov, and in episode 3, I'm delighted to be joined by Dr. Sara Ratner. Sara has been at the department since May 2023 and is a postdoctoral researcher working on pedagogy, AI, policy and innovation. Before coming to Oxford, she was a classroom teacher, school leader, lecturer, and went on to specialise in the delivery of large-scale digital assessment globally with a leading edtech company. She is currently the principal investigator on the AI in Education at Oxford University. That's the AIEOU hub. Hi, Sara. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So let's jump straight in and talk about the AIEOU hub. I'm going to have to start saying that much slower to get all the vowels in. The hub has gone from strength to strength and has just celebrated its first birthday in December. It's an interdisciplinary research entity which unites global experts and stakeholders to shape human-centred AI and education systems worldwide. Currently has more than 2,000 individuals on it. You've also recently enjoyed a hugely successful two-day in-person conference in Oxford in September. So tell our listeners about the AIEOU Hub. What's the aim?
Certainly. Well, it's very exciting, and it's hard to believe that it's been a year. In some ways it feels like 5 minutes, and in some ways it feels like 5 years with the pace of change and the momentum. The Hub really started out of a vision to look at this challenge of AI in education from all of the stakeholders' perspectives. And I think you made reference there to the various things I've done before, and that experience really informed this. I saw classroom teachers challenged by what AI could do for education. I saw policymakers struggling to develop policy that was useful and at pace to match what was evolving. I saw technology providers, quite honestly, grappling with how do they embrace the opportunity here but also make it relevant and meaningful for the people that would be using it. And I saw governments and organisations around the world really challenged by this. And for me, education is such an ecosystem, and the voices of everyone in that ecosystem are so important. The students, the teachers, the parents and families, the policymakers, the governments. And I really wanted to create a space here at Oxford for all of those stakeholders to come together and grapple with these challenges together, because in isolation, we can only see it from our point of view, and education is something that needs everyone's perspectives brought into clear focus.
So there are four pillars of the work. There's design, regulation, implementation and impact. Why have you decided on those four areas?
Great question. When we set up the Hub, it was myself and Elizabeth Wanacott, who's a professor here in the department, and Rebecca Williams, who's a professor in law. And each of us brought this our own research interests and challenges we wanted to solve as well. And we were trying to find four research themes that really encompassed the interests and needs of all the stakeholders. So design, we really wanted to look at from the technologist's perspective and the teachers and students' perspective, how could AI be designed to augment the best experience in education? From regulation, very much led by Rebecca in law, looking at how do we develop laws and policies and regulations that actually support users of this technology in a positive way? Implementation is really the daily work of education, like how do we take these tools and implement them at scale in classrooms and in education systems around the world? And then impact, which is probably the most important one for me, is like what does this actually mean for teaching and learning? Will this technology be used and designed and regulated and implemented in a way that actually will drive forward educational outcomes for all learners? So they were our four pillars because we felt they really not only gave voice to all of the stakeholders, but also really focused on the breadth of what is needed in the ecosystem we're working in.
And how was the conference in September?
The conference was amazing.
Good.
It was so much work. But, oh my goodness, it just, in fact, a very lovely person that I've worked with for many years at the OECD came to the conference, and she said to me, it felt like the Woodstock of AI. It was just like yeah. This, like there was so much connection and community and collaboration was just at the heart of it. And it really showed to me that you can work with excellence and be kind and nurturing and inclusive and collaborative in your approach. It was amazing. We got to hear from experts from around the world come and share their knowledge, share their wisdom, share their questions. And it's lovely to see the true sense of community that has developed from it. It was so much more than an academic conference.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to attend one of the days and I just thought there was such a buzz about it. Yeah. There were so many people excited and just thrilled to be part of this event in Oxford and being able to talk about everything and how they can influence AI and education in their institutions and in their own organisations globally. I thought it was amazing. And so many people were excited about what the next steps would be. What did you feel you came away excited about from it?
You know, when you have an idea, like a little kernel of an idea, yeah. And you think, I'm thinking about this problem this way. I wonder if anyone else is thinking about it this way. I wonder if this would resonate with anybody else. And I sort of, you know, I spoke to my colleagues and, you know, a couple of people were like, yeah, that's a really good idea. That's a good approach. And then I had the benefit of being at a UNESCO Digital Learning Week and I was speaking on a panel and I shared the idea and I said, like, does this resonate with anyone? And, you know, within an hour of the panel, we had 30 people, you know, emailing saying this resonates. Yeah. And then it's just grown and grown. And I think what I took away from this was when you have an idea and you have the courage to kind of go, what do we think about this way of thinking about it? And take that risk. And then you get people behind you and you get it on board and it moves forward. I was quite overwhelmed.
Yeah.
I've got to be honest. Like, sure. For the couple of weeks after the conference, I was still kind of, did that happen? Like, did that actually happen? But what I'm most excited now that I've got through that, is that the momentum has not only maintained but grown and accelerated, and the willingness of people to share and to contribute and collaborate in this way. And I'm really excited. So the next step for us is to go back to our community and say, what are the most pressing AI and education research questions around the world? Sharing those together, ranking them and saying, right, what are the 10 most pressing research questions we need to address as a community, and then bringing people back to Oxford to convene again to start the work to actually answer those questions.
What is it about AI in education that really specifically interests you?
I think for me, this is going to sound a bit silly.
No, that's fine.
Actually, it's not about the AI.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Which I know that sounds strange. What really excites me is that because of this sort of sudden, and AI is not new, right? But this generative AI that has kind of put AI into accessible to millions around the world and has accelerated at this pace, what it's done is it's enabled these conversations to happen about what good teaching and learning looks like, about what is the real purpose of education, what do we as educators, what is the value add that we bring to a child's life through good teaching and learning. And for me, this whole AI and education, I guess, movement, what really excites me is that we get to really rethink and reimagine what is it about education that we value the most, and how do we best move that forward in a way that is good for all, and hopefully in a way that creates this as a social good for everyone. So that's, yeah, it's more about the education than the AI, but the AI is kind of has fostered those conversations and made them happening everywhere.
With that in mind, what do you hope the outcomes of this piece of work will be?
There's a couple of things for this. First of all, I've always been a big believer when we have limited resources, the best way is to collaborate, not to replicate. So I'm really proud that Oxford has created this space for people to come together. Not because we think we've got the answers, but because we want to create the space for the questions to be asked. And I think if we can work in a really collaborative way and we can use that as a model for other global challenges that will happen, then that's a really exciting output for me. The second thing is I really hope that through this we can build our continued focus on education as a social and public good, and that AI can really augment that and perhaps increase accessibility for all learners around the world in diverse contexts, in diverse languages, and that we can really focus on a quality education for all.
I asked my last two guests, so I had Victoria Murphy and Luke Brewer, who's a former MLT student with us, what they thought about AI in education. And the consensus was, it's here to stay, so you'd better work with it. I'm fully paraphrasing there.
Yep.
Victoria was saying we need better research into AI in education, but to do great research, you need time. And one of the challenges of generative AI is that it's moving so rapidly. Do you agree with that?
100%. And that's what I really hope we can do through this hub. I mentioned earlier about the next stage is to get those research questions and then start the work on answering them. I think our teachers and our students and our schools in particular, they need reliable evidence as to what the impact this is going to have on teaching and learning and educational outcomes. We can only do that with the research. The challenge is that it's moving so fast. We don't have the time to collect and analyse the data that we need to in traditional ways. So I think in many ways we're going to have to be quite creative about how we do that research. And it may not necessarily fit our traditional ideas of research, which is going to be challenging for universities like ours. And particularly, you know, thinking about academic publication timelines and so on, you know, many of my colleagues and collaborators around the world will say, gosh, by the time we get this published, it's out of date, right? And that's a real challenge for the world we live and work in. So I think Victoria is absolutely correct. We desperately need the research and the reliable evidence to make informed decisions about AI in education. But we also need to think about how we can do that in non-traditional ways so that we can get the evidence we need into the hands of the people who are making big decisions right now.
So in preparation for this interview, I asked ChatGPT, we should say there are other generative AI chatbots available. There are many others.
This is not sponsored by anybody.
but I did ask ChatGPT what three things I should specifically ask you. And the first one it came up with was, what do people misunderstand most about AI in education, and why does that misunderstanding matter?
Gosh, ChatGPT.
The harder than my questions, right? I mean,
much harder. I think the thing that is probably the most misunderstood that I hear, and actually I'm going to rephrase that. It's not the most misunderstood. I think it's the thing that troubles me the most, if I can turn ChatGPT's question a little bit.
Yes.
I think the thing that troubles me the most is that people say AI will just replace teachers. That, you know, in AI tutors and various things, we won't need teachers in the future. And I think that kind of diminishes the role of a teacher to a content deliverer. And I think there are incredible things that AI can do now and will be able to do in the future. I find it hard to imagine a world where teachers are not needed. I think the role of a teacher, having been one for a very long time, is so much more than teaching curriculum content. And I think when I'm very fortunate to still be in contact with a lot of students that I taught. And, you know, the things that they remember about our shared experiences or times together or things that I've taught them in the past, they're never about curriculum, right? They're always about things that happened on a school camp or things that you know, I used to do in terms of our daily routine or well-being things or, you know, a whole range of things that teachers do. So I think we've got to think about the role of a teacher, and maybe there is actually a great opportunity to review the role of a teacher, the job of a teacher, because, gosh, it's a big job. And AI can perhaps support with a teacher's time, but I think the value add that a good teacher brings to a child's life can't be replaced by AI, in my opinion.
That was very relevant to something that Luke was saying in episode two. He's a current teacher. And he was talking a lot about his class and being able to interact with them and just getting a feel for where they are in terms of mental health or stresses and worries inside the classroom, outside the classroom, what's going on with them. And I suppose AI will never be able to replicate or replace that. So that, you know, there's like you say, a whole element of teaching which just can't be replaced. But maybe there are things which it can help with, like assessment.
Look, I think there are many things where AI can, you know, augment a teacher's work, absolutely. But I think back to my own classroom days and I don't know, there's something about a class of kids on a windy day, right? when it's lunchtime and they're outside playing, particularly in Australia, so it's hot and then you get this hot wind, right? And it's the kids go a bit loopy, right? There's no way your lesson is going as planned after a windy lunchtime, right? And so you have to, take the children in the state that they are when they come in, yeah. Right? And you adapt accordingly. Now, I can't imagine a world where AI is going, oh, gosh, that wonderful history lesson I had planned for year nine on Friday afternoon is not going to happen because they've just come in from this crazy lunchtime and actually we need to stop and rethink or deal with the whole kerfuffle that they've just had on the playground and manage that. So, yeah, I think Luke's right.
How old were the kids you were teaching?
So I taught a range over my career. So I've taught from five-year-olds right up to 17-year-olds. Range from K to 12.
What's your favourite age group? Is that maybe that's really controversial to ask a teacher, sorry.
Do you know what? Probably my favourite year group was always, and the one I seemed to end up teaching the most was in Australia was year six. So that was the final year of primary school before they went to high school. And it was that time of transition where some of them are still really little kids and some of them are like men and women. Like Aww. It's just this time of real change and transition for them. And I loved working with that age group. But I do have to say I think the most valuable teacher in any school is the reception or kindergarten teacher. I think they work so hard. Their job is so hard. And I have utmost respect for anyone that tells me they've taught five-year-olds.
Is that because five-year-olds are quite hard work or why is that?
They are quite hard work. But also like everything is like learning to read, learning to write, learning how to fit into the social structures of school. Like everything.
Everything's new.
Everything is new.
Yeah. Okay, the second question that AI told me to ask you was from your work at Oxford, what ethical challenge in AI-supported learning do you think deserves urgent public attention?
Oh, another great question. I would say the issue of data autonomy is something I'm thinking a lot about at the moment. And I think in particular, having made the move from one country to another, I see like all of the educational records about my daughter have stayed in Australia, right? Oh. In her school in Australia. They don't move with the child. And there's all these data points that we collect about a child through their life that for me, I'm thinking they need to belong to the child. And I'm really interested to see how that could evolve for good or bad through the age of AI. We could actually address this problem and have children and adults own their own data in a really clever way if we did this right. But also it could be highly problematic in terms of sharing things into AI platforms and not quite fully understanding the way they're being managed and processed and handled. So I think for me that's a really big ethical challenge that in education we have to get right.
Who would be the stakeholders as well in that? And presumably there would be a lot of different organisations that would need to come together to A, facilitate it and B, be comfortable with what was being shared left, right and also to the, I suppose, end user.
Well, that's the thing and I think it's a big problem that we need to be thinking about is how do we as individuals own the information about us and use that to inform the choices we want to make in the future, rather than not quite knowing where all the bits of information about us are being held. And I think it's, as we move more and more into this kind of algorithmic decision-making about life choices and pathways that are open to us or closed to us, I think those critical questions are going to be, for me, they're the most pressing ethical questions for us right now.
So the final question that AI told me to ask you was looking ahead 5 to 10 years, very specifically, how do you think AI will most meaningfully change the role of teachers and learners?
That's a really challenging question because we don't know how AI may develop and evolve in the next 5 to 10 years. We also don't really know what the response from teachers and learners might be to AI.
Yes.
Because I think back to Victoria's comment, we don't yet have the research and the evidence to really know the impact. So I think the next 5 years is actually going to be a really interesting time because we will get the research together and the evidence that we need to know the impact of this. And then teachers and learners can make a really informed decision as to how they want to best use this or not use this. And I think that will be the most meaningful thing that we see in the next 5 to 10 years.
I think it's interesting that AI has come up with those timescales itself to judge itself on. So maybe my next question should have been back to AI saying, what do you think is happening in the next 10 years? What do you know that we don't know?
Yeah, maybe. But then we have to remember AI is not really, you know, it's code and stuff at the moment, right? It's not. And I think that's a big challenge that we face into is because we're seeing AI more and more as a thing or something that we have a relationship with, and actually it's lines of code, right? And I think that's really important as well to remember, because increasingly we're kind of anthropomorphizing AI. And look, I very much see it as a sort of co-constructor, co-creator as a tool, but I'm very conscious of remembering that it is a tool, and it is, you know, it's simply predicting what is the most probable next word to put. And I think that is something that we really need to make sure as educators that our young people and in our schools are well aware of.
So that's a really good point. And maybe for our listeners, for those who know very little about AI, we should just touch base on that and explain. So generative AI is literally based around large language models. Mm. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what would be the quickest way to explain how that works to somebody who doesn't know anything about it?
Look, I think it's... in a very simple way, and I never claim to be a technical expert on this, right? So my world is around policy and pedagogy and how this technology will impact that. But for me, the way I rationalize it in my mind is like, if you imagine, you know, taking all of the world's content and knowledge and books in the library and reading them all and saying, from all of that information that I've read, when presented with this question, I'm going to look at what is the most probable response to that based on all the information I have. And that's how I view it.
Yes. Right?
It's looking at what is the most probable next word or next phrase or next step.
But it's based on the whole internet. So every single thing.
Well, it's more than the internet. It's everything.
Everything.
Everything that's been, it's been trained on.
Yeah. So last year, Professor Geoffrey Hinton, who is known as the godfather of AI, gave the Romaines Lecture at the university, and he shared his concerns around the potential for AI to take over and the need to do research now to ensure that humans stay in control. Mm-hmm. That's me paraphrasing, but that was the premise of the lecture. Do you share his concerns?
Well, I do, because any tool or thing that we develop as humans can be... humans can use it for good, they can use it for bad, right? So I do worry about that. And it's why I think kind of, you know, good governance and regulation is so important. But it's also got to be good governance and regulation that enables us to also take what is the best of this potential technology, right? It's incredibly useful for, you know, children with diverse learning needs and accessibility issues and, you know, neurodiverse learners. It's has incredible potential. So... but I do worry, as with anything, things can be used for good and for bad. I think it's why having the human in the loop is always so important, and having human-centered approaches to policy, to whatever we develop, having that human expertise in the loop is so important. A former colleague and good friend of mine at the OECD, Professor Tomoya Okubo, has developed something called the Collective Intelligence Model for Education. And what I love about his model is that it very much has the human expert in the loop. And I think that's what we really need to be front and centre having, just to ensure that the things that we're doing remain human-focused, human-centred, human-led.
Moving away from AI now... as you mentioned earlier on, you're Australian and by accent, but I was very intrigued to find out.
What do you mean? I didn't think I had an accent.
I don't think I've sound northern either, but people keep telling me I do. I was really interested to find out recently that you were actually born in the north of England.
I was.
So walk me through where you started, how you went over, how you ended up in Sydney, and then how you came back to Oxford.
Yeah, certainly. So I was born in Manchester, not far from you.
No.
And... when I was one, my family emigrated to Australia for my dad's work. So we found ourselves in Australia. I did all my education in Australia, had a beautiful childhood, very lucky, and most of my professional career was in Australia. So I taught there, I worked in edtech there. I had an have incredible family and friends there. Like it was beautiful. And when I was working in edtech, and I'd sort of moved out of schools, was working in edtech, and have always been a lifelong learner. My husband teases me. He's like, I think you have more letters after your name than in your name, because I calls me a degree collector. But I've never not been studying, right? I just and it's something my parents instilled with me from a very early age, that education, you can take it anywhere and it will get you anywhere. So I moved into edtech and finished my master's and went on to do my PhD. So I was working in Sydney, Australia, and also doing my PhD at the University of Sydney. And I loved it. And had a wonderful supervisor, Professor Jim Tognolini, who said to me, I think you need to go and spend some time in Oxford. And I was like, Jim, you're crazy. Oxford's not for someone like me, right? That was my exact words. He's like, no, I think it's where you need to be. So he helped me write a letter to apply as a recognised student here. So I came and spent a year in the Centre for Education Assessment here at Oxford, and absolutely just fell in love with this place. And I just found my people, I found my place, I just absolutely loved it. And so when my year as a recognised student came to an end, and, you know, at the same time sort of jobs and work was changing in the edtech industry, and so I decided that was the time to leave edtech and that we would stay here for a longer period of time. And I applied for a postdoc researcher role with the LIFT team, Learning in Families Through Technology. And I saw the ad and I thought, oh, this is really interesting for me because it's about edtech and technology, which obviously I'd worked in for many years, but also it's really focused on early childhood education, and I had a background in obviously in school education, and I thought this is a really important piece of work to be part of. And so I applied, and I had this interview with Victoria Murphy and Sandra Mathers and Fiona Jelly, who were on the team, and they interviewed me. And I remember afterwards I went to my husband and I was like, I would do that job if they didn't pay me. Like, they are so lovely and I really want to work with them. And he was like, oh, well, see what happens. It'd be good if they did pay you.
Ideally.
Ideally. But it was just, you know, when you meet people and you're just like, oh, the work they're doing is just something I want to be part of. And then Vicky rang me the next day and she said, we'd really like to, you know, offer you the job. I was like, really? She's like, yeah. So I started working with the LIFT team, and I love working here. I love being around people who are just so clever and fun and warm and inclusive. And I never, you know, like when I said, oh, Oxford's not for someone like me.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, it has blown me away. And every time I've sort of said, oh, I'm thinking about this idea, or I've knocked on the door of someone and said, could I talk to you about this? Every door is open. Every person is interested in having a conversation. And I never would have dreamed I would end up where I am. But I think for anyone that says Oxford's not for me, you just...
Why do you think you felt it wasn't?
I think I had this idea, like, it's, you know, it's the best university in the world. It's top department in the UK. I was like, it's more about me than about Oxford, right? That feeling. And I think it's, I don't think the imposter syndrome ever really goes away. Like, you know, you sit in the rooms here and you think, gosh, this is amazing. But then with that incredible privilege comes also great responsibility. And it's why the work that I'm doing now feels so important to me, because if I've got this opportunity, and I've got this ability to use this space to bring people together to address this big challenge, then it's really important to do that. I feel a responsibility to do that.
Is it the university you love? Is it the whole of Oxford? What, apart from what you've just been saying about your professional opportunities here, is it this? Do you love the city as well?
Yeah, it could not be more different to Sydney.
I would. Right. I've never been to Sydney, but I would imagine so.
Like, when you compare the two, and I love Sydney, but gosh, there's something magical about this place. But I think also it's when we moved to Oxford, do you know what? It was a lot of different things, right? And my mum had just passed away. Life was a big time of change in my life. And I came here and I just, it felt like a coming home in a really unusual way. And I think part of that was, you know, probably with losing my mum and then coming back to where she was from and all of that as well. So there was a timing of things there that just came together. My daughter, she just is flourishing. Like, she just absolutely loves it. And, you know, my husband's so happy here. He's found incredible friends in a network. And I think, you know, when something just works for your family and it's happy family, happy life, right? Yes. If my family are happy, I'm happy. So we're all...
Everything aligned.
It's everything.
Yeah. But you must miss the weather in Sydney.
Oh, I do. I miss the sun. And what's this dark at 4 o'clock in the afternoon business? Like, come on.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
Oh, my goodness.
Remember?
I've always wanted to be a teacher.
Really?
Always. So I remember when I was 3, there was a photo of me and I had all my toys lined up on my bed and I was teaching them how to read. My parents have said that you were always a teacher, and I think a little bit bossy too, but always a teacher. And I remember for my 5th birthday, I said to my parents that I wanted a chalkboard. And they got me one of those, you know, those little ones that stand up on an easel that little kids have. And I cried and they were like, why are you crying? And I said, no, I want one on the wall like the teacher has. And they were like, oh, my goodness. So, yeah, I can't imagine being anything but a teacher.
I cried when I got a Barbie dream house and I don't know what that says about me.
You wanted to live in the dream house maybe.
You have an incredibly busy professional life. How do you balance that with home life and also being a mum to your daughter?
I think for me, my work is incredibly important to me. And as I said, I feel this great responsibility to do good work. But it's always family first for me.
Yes.
And my daughter is the most amazing thing I've ever achieved. Like, she's far beyond me, right? She's just incredible. So, yeah, my family is everything to me. So they will always come first. But it's wonderful. And as she's growing older, she recently got to come to her first academic conference with me.
Oh.
And it was so lovely. She's just the number one cheerleader. And she's so proud of her mum. And I think, you know, that also comes back to a responsibility as a parent. Like, we sometimes feel like, you know, if we're doing good work, we're not being a good parent. But actually, for my 15-year-old daughter, she's looking at me going, wow, I can do that too one day. I can have a dream and have a vision and make it happen. And her vision and dream will be very different to mine, and I hope it is. I hope she finds whatever is hers. But if she can look at her mum and go, oh, you can make things happen, then job done, right?
So I'm curious, is anyone else in your family in education? Or you just wanted to be a teacher from the get-go?
I just always wanted to be a teacher. So my mum worked in schools, but she wasn't a teacher.
Right.
And interesting, she worked in the schools that I went to because it was just easier. She was just like, you know, finish at the same time if you can take you home. Like, it was, but she was not a teacher. She just worked in those schools. So, yeah, it wasn't that it was, you know, my family didn't come from a, you know, strong educational background, but they always instilled in me that education comes first, and no matter what happens in the world, no matter where you end up, being well educated is number one. So I actually remember it. We came back for a Christmas to visit my grandmother in Manchester, and my mum brought me to Oxford in, I don't know, the year 2000 or something, and she bought a dictionary in Blackwell's, and in front of the dictionary she said, one day you'll come here. And she gave it to me, and I still have that. And it reminds me, because for her, education was everything, and she's always instilled that in me.
It also states on your LinkedIn profile you're passionate about advancing literacy as a global gateway to learning, and as you mentioned, also AI earlier on. Why is this important to you?
Look, for me, I think literacy skills and particularly early literacy development is the key to success in life. Right? Equipping people with the literacy skills they need to thrive and flourish in the world. And I think sadly a lot of children don't have access to the tools they need to develop those early literacy skills. And a lot of parents don't have the ability to support and develop those early literacy skills in their young children as well. So for me, that's a really important piece of work and something that the LIFT team that I mentioned earlier is working on to support as well. And it's why that project spoke so strongly to me. I think if we can develop tools that are informed by educational research and develop freely available and accessible tools in lots of languages so that children have the ability to develop literacy skills in their home language, I think that is fundamental to the future of the world. You know, it's how do we create a world in which young people can flourish and thrive? Well, we need to be able to give them the literacy skills they need to do that.
Thinking about your career, your profession, what do you find the most challenging thing about it?
Time. I feel like I need 3 lifetimes to do all the things that I would love to achieve. So I think it's about how do you manage your time and put the boundaries around that time to do excellent work, but also be excellent to the people in your lives and look after yourself. So I think time is the biggest challenge. Looking back on my career, I've never gone into anything with a plan. I know that sounds silly, doesn't it? I didn't plan to end up as, you know, in academia. I didn't plan to end up at Oxford. I just kind of, when things presented themselves to me and I had the courage to say yes and give it a go. And so I think that's probably another challenge for my career as well. Like you know, when people sort of sit down and they map out, you know, I'm going to be this by this stage and then I'm going to bring, I've never really done that. And I feel like I've had a couple of careers. You know, I've had my teaching career. Yeah. I've had my corporate ed tech C-suite experience, and I wouldn't give up either for the world because I learned so much by doing all of that.
What have been the highlights of your career so far?
Oh, that's a challenging question.
Is it as challenging as ChatGPT was earlier?
Yeah, no. Sorry, that's such an Australian expression. Yeah, nah. So there's been a couple of highlights. I think when I was working in EdTech, the key partner that I worked with was the OECD, and we worked on delivering the PISA for Schools assessment around the world. And there was a moment in time when we got to bring all the countries that we were working with together and have a meeting at the OECD. And I remember sitting there thinking, like, 17 education ministries around the world were represented, and I was thinking about all the teachers that were part of those ministries and then all the students that were part of those ministries and the impact that that work had had on their education. And it kind of, you know, it took my breath for a moment to think that the work we were doing was having that kind of impact. So that was a really special moment at the OECD. Another highlight would definitely be our conference this year for AIEOU, because it felt like a moment of bringing together all the different threads of my career and then being here and having the, I guess, bravery to go, could we do this? And then having it happen and having it so overwhelmingly supported by people from across the globe felt like a huge achievement. It was one of those things. We had on the first day of the conference, we had a conference dinner at St. John's College, and we had about 100 people in the room, and I was sitting on the high table with Antra Fethin, who's currently the Pro Vice Chancellor Digital. And she's been a huge supporter of our hub and an incredible mentor to me, along with Victoria Murphy. And we were doing speeches of thanks to everyone, you know, and then I was given a bouquet of flowers and a thank you. And the whole dining hall stood on their feet and clapped to you. Like, I'm going to cry now even thinking about it. And I remember Anne turning to me and she said, whenever you get an email and you think, oh, is that really for me? Or you're invited into a room and you think, is that really for me? She said, you remember this moment.
Yeah.
And I was like, it was just such an incredible. So I think that would absolutely be a career highlight for me. Yeah. But, you know, there are so many things. And I think it sounds so silly, but there's also so many moments like where, you know, a child that I'd worked with in a classroom that had struggled with something for 3 months and then suddenly had that eureka moment of understanding something, like, that to me is, you can't replace that feeling of knowing that you've helped a child unlock something that was locked.
And final question.
Yeah.
How do you hope your career will progress? So what research would you like to work on in the future? Mm. Where do you see yourself going?
Oh, that's a great question. I think I see myself going wherever is meant for me, right? I'm not quite sure what that is, but if it's meant for me, it will happen. In terms of research, I really want to dig deep into this AI and education and really get the voices from across the world to say, what are the big questions that we need to answer here? And then how can we come together to answer them? And I think for me, that is the research that I really want to see happen. And I would love to see us be able to publish that research and share it openly for the rest of the world to also be able to engage with and build that research, because it's got to be global, it's got to be collaborative, and it's got to be far-reaching so that teachers and learners can make informed decisions about how they want to use AI moving forward.
So much more to come.
So much more to come.
Thanks so much for your time, Sarah. I really appreciate it. I know
it's
how busy you
pleasure.
Are, so thank you, and I'm sure our listeners will find this absolutely fascinating. You can find out more about the department, the AIEOU Hub, and Sarah on our website, education.ox.ac.uk. Join us again next time for another episode of Education Explored, the Department of Education at the University of Oxford podcast.